never sold since then. Had there been so many squeaky fences over that one. And when Bob the Shaw came up to the gas with a song, she tripped over the coal scuttle with disastrous results. The coal rolled to every part of the room. Her slate was broken into fragments, and when she picked herself up, her face, stained with coal dust, sent the boys into roars of laughter. Anne turned from the second reader class which she was hearing. "Really, Barbara," she said icily, "if you cannot move without falling over something, you'd better remain in your seat. It is positively disgraceful for a girl of your age to be so awkward." Poor Barbara stumbled back to her desk, her tears combining with the coal dust, producing an effect truly grotesque. Never before had her beloved, sympathetic teacher spoken to her in such a tone or fashion, and Barbara was heartbroken. Anne herself was a prick of conscience, but it only served to increase her mental irritation. And the second reader class remembered that lesson yet, as well as the unmerciful infliction of arithmetic that followed. Just as Anne was snapping the sums out, Sinclair Donnell arrived breathlessly. "You are half an hour late, Sinclair," Anne reminded him frigidly. "Why is this?" "Please, miss, I had to help Mom make a pudding for dinner since we're expecting company and Clarice Almira is sick," was Sinclair's answer, given in a perfectly respectful voice, but nevertheless provocative of great mirth among his mates. "Take your seat and work out the six problems on page 84 of your arithmetic, your punishment," said Anne. Sinclair looked at her amazed in her tone, but he went meekly to his desk and took out his slate. Then he stealthily passed a small parcel to Joe Sloan across the aisle. Anne caught him in the act and jumped to a fatal conclusion about that parcel. Old Mrs. Hiram Sloan had lately taken to making and selling nut cakes by way of adding to her scanty income. The cakes were specially tempting to small boys, and for several weeks Annie had not a little trouble in regard to them. On their way to school, the boys would invest their spare cash at Mrs. Hiram's, bring the cakes along with them to school, and, if possible, eat them and treat their mates during school hours. Anne had warned them that if they brought any more cakes to school, they would be confiscated, and yet here was Sinclair Donnell, coolly passing a parcel of them wrapped up in the blue and white striped paper Mrs. Hiram used under her very eyes. "Joseph," said Anne quietly, "bring that parcel here." Joe, startled and abashed, obeyed. He was a fat urchin who always blushed and stuttered when he was frightened. Never did anybody look more guilty than poor Joe at that moment. "Throw it into the fire," said Anne. Joe looked very blank. "Please, miss," he began. "Do as I tell you, Joseph, without any words about it. But, miss, there. Gasped Joe in desperation. "Joseph, are you going to obey me or are you not?" said Anne. A bolder and more self-possessed lad than Joe Sloan would have been overawed by her tone and the dangerous flash of her eyes. This was a new Anne, whom none of her pupils had ever seen before. Lawrence Rowan had sent to town had sent Caradonnell's father the day before, intending to have a birthday celebration that evening. The crackers went off in a thunderclap of noise, and the pinwheels bursting out of the door spun madly around the room, hissing and spluttering. Anne dropped into her chair, white with dismay, and all the girls climbed shrieking upon their desks. Joe Sloane stood as one transfixed in the midst of the commotion, and St. Clair, helpless with laughter, rocked to and fro in the aisle. Toby Rogers fainted, and Annetta Bell went into hysterics. It seemed a long time, although it was really only a few minutes, for the last pinwheel subsided. Anne, recovering herself, sprang to open doors and windows and let out the gas and smoke which filled the room. Then she helped the girls carry the unconscious Prillie into the porch, where Barbara Shaw, in an agony of desire to be useful, poured a pailful of half-frozen water over Prillie's face and shoulders before anyone could stop her. It was a full hour before quiet was restored, but it was a quiet that might be felt. Everybody realized that even the explosion had not cleared the teacher's mental atmosphere. Nobody, except Anthony Pye, dared whisper a word. Ned Clay accidentally squeaked his pencil while working a sum, caught Anne's eye, and wished the floor would open and swallow him up. The geography class raced through a continent with the speed that made them dizzy. The grammar class were parsed and analyzed within an inch of their lives. Chester Sloane, spelling odoriferous with two F's, was made to feel that he could never live down the disgrace of it, either in this world or that which is to come. Anne knew that she had made herself ridiculous, and that the incident would be laughed over that night at the score of tea tables, but the knowledge only angered her further. In a calmer mood, she could have carried off the situation with a laugh, but now that was impossible, for she ignored it in the face of disdain. When Anne returned to the school after dinner, all the children were as usual in their seats, and every face as bent to be as steel over a desk, except Anthony Pye's. He peered across his book at Anne, his black eyes sparkling with curiosity and mockery. Anne pushed open the drawer of her desk in search of chalk, and under her very hand a lively mouse sprang out of the floor, scampered over the desk, and leapt to the floor. Anne screamed and sprang back as if it had been a snake, and Anthony Pye laughed aloud. Then a silence fell, a very creepy, uncomfortable silence. Annetta Bell was of two minds whether to go into hysterics again or not, especially as she didn't know just where the mouse had gone. But she decided not to. Who could take any comfort out of hysterics with a teacher so white-faced and so blazing-eyed standing before one? "Who put that mouse in my desk?" said Anne. Her voice was quite low, but it made a shiver go up and down Paul Irving's spine. Joe Sloane caught her eye, felt responsible from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet, but stuttered out wildly, "Not me, teacher. Not me." Anne paid no attention to the threats of Joseph. She looked at Anthony Pye, and Anthony Pye looked back, unabashed and unashamed. "Anthony, was it you?" "Yes, it was." would pointer. Come here, Anthony. It was far from being the most severe punishment Anthony Prime had ever undergone. Anne, even the stormy-souled Anne she was at that moment, could not have punished any child cruelly. But the pointer missed keenly, and finally Anthony's bravado failed him. He winced, and the tears came to his eyes. Anne, conscience-stricken, dropped the pointer and pulled Anthony to go to the seat. She sat down at her desk, feeling ashamed, repentant, and bitterly mortified. Her quick anger was gone, and she would have given much to have been able to seek relief in tears. So all her boasts had come to this. She had actually whipped one of her pupils. How Jane would triumph, and how Mr. Harrison would chuckle. But worse than this, bitterest thought of all, she had lost her last chance of winning Anthony's eye. Never would he like her now. And, by what somebody has called a Herculean effort, kept back her tears until she got home that night. Then she shut herself in the East Gable room and wrapped all her shame and remorse and disappointment into her pillows, wept so long that Marilla grew alarmed, invaded the room, and insisted on knowing what the trouble was. "The trouble is, I've got things the matter with my conscience," sobbed Anne. "Oh, this has been such a Jonah day, Marilla. I'm so ashamed of myself. I lost my temper and whipped Anthony Prime." "I'm glad to hear it," said Marilla with decision. "It's what you should have done long ago." "Oh, no, no, Marilla. And I don't see how I can ever look those children in the face again. I feel that I have humiliated myself to the very dust. You don't know how cross and hateful and horrid I was. I can't forget the expression in Paul Irving's eyes. He looked so surprised and disappointed. Oh, Marilla, I have tried so hard to be patient with the women Anthony's liking, and now it is all gone for nothing." Marilla passed her hard, work-worn hand over the girl's glossy, tumbled hair with a wonderful tenderness. When Anne's sobs grew quieter, she said, very gently for her, "You take things too much to heart, Anne. We all make mistakes, but people forget them. And Jonah days come to everybody. As for Anthony Prime, why need you care if he does dislike you? He's the only one." "I can't help it. I want everybody to love me, and it hurts me so when anybody doesn't. And Anthony never will now. Oh, I just made an idiot of myself today, Marilla. I'll tell you the whole story." Marilla listened to the whole story, and as she smiled at certain parts of it, Anne never knew. When the tale was ended, she said briskly, "Well, never mind. Today's done, and there's a new one coming tomorrow with no mistakes in it yet, as you used to say yourself. Just come downstairs and have your supper. You'll see if a good cup of tea and those plum puffs I made today won't hurt you up." "Plum puffs won't minister to a mind disease," said Anne disconsolately. But Marilla thought it a good sign that she had recovered sufficiently to adapt the quotation. The cheerful supper table with the twins' bright faces and Marilla's matchless plum puffs, of which they ate four, did hearten her up considerably after all. She had a good sleep that night and awakened in the morning to find herself and He says he believes you are some good after all, even if you are a girl. Says that whipping you gave him was just as good as a man's. I never expected to win him by whipping him, though, says Annie a little mournfully, feeling that her ideals had played her false on him. It doesn't seem right. I'm sure my theory of kindness can't be wrong. No, but the pies are an exception to every known rule, that's what, declared Mrs. Rakey with conviction. Mr. Harrison said, thought you'd come to it when he heard it, and Jane roped it in rather unmercifully. End